the counter move always is to say, yeah, it's because I'm connected that I care. And as soon as I try to do anything, I am definitely going to fuck up because it's too complicated. But that's just the beginning.
This is the Ecology of Ideas podcast, the podcast about how the ecological crisis is foremost a crisis in our ways of thinking. I'm Otto D'Amato. Just thinking about the ecological crisis and what we can do about it can overwhelm any of us. It can lead to a sense of despair and an attitude of, I can't change anything anyway, so why bother trying? Today's guest is Alexis Shotwell, professor in sociology and anthropology at Carleton University in Canada. According to Alexis, this attitude is a product of what she refers to as purity politics. Purity politics is the lie that only those of us who pass some sort of purity check are allowed to participate in collective action. And so it is very easy to shut down our political impulses to come together and try to change what we can. How to overcome this purity politics and not to despair will be the topic of our conversation. And now, let's welcome Alexis to the podcast. Hi, Alexis. Welcome to the Ecology of Ideas podcast. You are dialing in all the way from Canada. How are you doing?
I am good. Very happy to be here with you.
No, thanks. We are really happy to have you. Just for our audience, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I live in Ottawa and ceded Algonquin territory, and I teach at Carleton University. I'm in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology and cross-appointed to philosophy and the Feminist Institute for Social Transformation, FIST. So I have a lot of different hats. And I work generally on questions of purity politics, which we'll be talking about, but also on things that you know but cannot say in words and why those matter. And right now I'm writing a book about making meaning in the midst of climate devastation and ecological catastrophe. Yeah. So lots of points of attachment for us, I think.
It really nicely links up with the idea behind this podcast is to understand ecology as an ecology of ideas that are all interconnected in one way or even entangled, not just connected, not just related, but entangled, and give each other meaning and in a sense, life, I think. So I'm just curious, before we go into the subject matter, what can your understanding of philosophy and sociology and anthropology contribute and help us understand?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I moved from I was a philosophy professor and I moved into this job as a sociologist 11 years ago. And part of the reason that I did that shift was because I wanted to be able to think exactly as you're saying, more about entanglement and complexity and the things that don't reduce down to anything, but instead become more complicated. Yeah. So I'm still passionately interested in the ethical and political questions of complexity and entanglement and being in this space where we can think about the social world, the natural world, and how we need to be able to think them together really has been motivating. So for me, when we start thinking about ecology, what we're doing there is thinking about ourselves as part of the world, and therefore thinking about how we think about it as important. So I think there's a fundamental generosity in thinking about the ecology of ideas as part of the ecological work we're doing as humans to care for the world that we've harmed and that we're continuing to destroy. So I think one of the reasons that I love, in the academy, we talk about theory, which sounds like a really abstract, why would we bring that up but really it's how do we make an account of what's happening? How do we tell a story about it? How do we understand it?
Yeah.
And if we don't mix ourselves and those capacities that we have to think about things and understand things, if we don't mix those with the dreadful problems we're in, we're not really going to ever be able to help. So I think that's one of the places where I feel like I think actually everyone is a theorist. In some way, everyone is a social theorist. And we all just could get better at doing that together in relation with the world that we love, you know?
Well, that's really, really beautifully said to reinstate the notion of theory as its original understanding, as something of knowing and understanding and practicing, because it has kind of gotten a bad rap as something that you do sitting in an ivory tower. And it's not it. It's about explaining, understanding our relationship to each other and the world we live in as a part of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very much, it's not abstract. It's how do we live?
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to stay close to the world means that our understanding has to match it in one way or another so we can resonate with it.
Yeah, I love that. How do we stay close to the world? That's lovely.
In a sense, I think your notion about purity politics is a very evocative way of thinking about our role in the world and what we are kind of striving to get rid of or to demystify in a sense. And I'm wondering, what is the role of purification in your mind or in your sense that we need to be careful of and try to understand and then tackle?
Yeah. So I started thinking about purity politics coming out of that my first book about knowledge. And when I moved into sociology as a discipline. And really it came from a couple of different roots. So one was that I eat vegan and became really irritated with many of my fellow vegans who were very self-righteous and really felt like if you just ate vegan, then you weren't implicated in suffering. And I felt like this is clearly ridiculous, right? There's no food without death. If we make a delineation to say the cow's suffering matters, but the suffering of the worms that get chewed up in plowing the field for the vegetables don't matter. We're just committing a different kind of error to say that mammal suffering is important and worm suffering is not. So it started with this just kind of very, these people who I also care about are irritating, which honestly I think is mostly how academics do any of our work. You know, this thing that I care about is also irritating.
I agree.
But then at the same time, I really started thinking about, especially I had more and more friends who were having kids. And so they were trying to figure out like what food to feed their kids and becoming very worried about pesticides and wanting to not, you know, feed their kids, you know, wanting to feed their kids organic strawberries, not poisoned strawberries. And then also I had a friend whose child ate some lead paint and had some really terrible health effects from the lead in the paint at the house they were renting. And it just, it all sort of came together in this complicated bundle where it's clear to me that just trying to personally not eat meat doesn't solve suffering. It's also really clear to me that making parents personally responsible for their children's sickness is a non-starter, right? So that you're just supposed to somehow, and it doesn't just happen with parents and children. We see that that tendency also when people say, oh, you got cancer. Did you smoke? Did you not eat enough antioxidants? Didn't you exercise enough? So this kind of making the individual responsible for what's actually happening, which is that we're all just swimming in a soup of incredible toxins and poisons that we can't personally manage. But I absolutely did not think it was okay that my friend's two-year-old was exposed to this lead paint because the landlord refused to do remediation and they could not afford to live somewhere else. So I wanted to be able to think about purity in a way that allowed us to reject lead paint poisoning and call for something better than just individually managing our health and stake out a space where we can be doing our best, but it's not going to solve everything, right? So all of those things came together for me in this, in thinking about purity politics as a problem and something we should reject.
I would love to go into the depths of it. I would really love to hear more about how you make that argument in such a way that it's not misunderstood as an endorsement of, well, you know, you got to poison the environment. It's just, it's natural to do it.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that happens is people have, I think anyone alive right now has some understanding that we are living in a way where we're living in a way where just being alive means that we're implicated in terrible things that are happening. And I think most of us have an understanding that that implication or being complicit in things that we wish weren't the case is uneven. So I live in North America. I use enormously more resources than people in other parts of the world. I fly for work, right? Like I'm more complicit in ecological destruction. And the purity politics mode would be to say, just you try to personally manage. You try, you don't, you know, eat this way, act this way, be this way. And then there's a bunch of other possible reactions. So that approach, the sort of like constrain yourself, you know, make yourself as small as possible, is never going to actually work, right? Because just being alive, as you say, means that we're involved.
Yeah, exactly.
So the other responses, there's a variety of them, which I think of under the umbrella of the fuck it response, which is just things are so awful. Fuck it. And this is, this happens on the individual level when people say, I should fly a lot right now because in 10 years, I don't think it's going to be possible anymore. Yeah. And I want to see as many places as possible. So there's this real turn to say, I'm going to actively participate in the thing that is making it impossible in the future to fly. I'm going to use as many resources as I can because they're scarce. So that's a particular mode. The bigger mode that we're in is just capitalism, which says that for a price, you can poison as much of the world as you can pay for or as you can get away with. So when we think about finding a middle ground, part of what I want to really emphasize is the individual approach is always going to fail. And that's why, historically, corporations have encouraged us to think of ourselves as individually and personally responsible for climate change, for pollution, when in fact, it is almost not at all our individual choices that make the difference, but instead the masses of decisions that are made by states who are running military operations that are incredibly destructive, and corporations in combination with state agencies that just pay to pollute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the middle ground, weirdly enough, I think, turns out to be committing wholeheartedly to the things that address those bigger complications.
Mm-hmm.
So at the level of the collective, that means people individually contributing to collective work to fight against those big things. That means people getting involved in social movements that work toward peace and that curb corporate maleficence.
Mm-hmm.
At the personal level, it's something else, because there's nothing we can do to be outside of the things we hate. So we're always trying to find a way to live with as much care and integrity as we can, recognizing that it's not enough.
Yeah.
So I think there's a political answer to your question and a personal answer.
That's kind of part of the problem, to isolate us from this ecology of ideas, thinking that it's up to us individually to deal with the situations. And I'm wondering where this idea came from, this idea that we have to be as pure as possible to also participate in these political movements. There's also this flip side that you're not pure enough to participate because you're not recycling or because you're not eating the kinds of food you should, or you don't believe the right ideology, or you're not pure enough. It's kind of the flip side of the same coin.
That's right.
Where this historically comes from, because it's not by happenstance that we are in this, we're entangled in this purity politics.
Yeah, so the deep history of purity politics, like everything else, is really complicated and not something we can just immediately reject. So yeah. I identify the origins of purism or purity politics also with the origins of modernity, which it's important to remember were fantastic in a certain way. So there was a moment where the rights of the individual became something that we could talk about politically. So coming out of feudalism and being able to say, individuals have standing. We should be respected and not subsumed into someone else's goals.
Mm-hmm.
So that impulse was the source of a lot of liberation in our world, right?
Yeah.
So people being able to say, I deserve respect at the boundary of my skin. I'm a human who has dignity, has been some of the engine for resisting chattel enslavement, you know, for resisting feudalism, like the impulses of the Enlightenment in Europe, the impulses of people being able to claim dignity all over the world have been about that sort of coming back to recognizing that the individual matters.
Yeah.
So all of that was, of course, very complicated. It was built in that moment on exactly as a conception of the individual came out. It was always marked by what that individual was not. So that it was white men can own property, and how you know that you're a property owner is that there are people who do not. So at the same time as there was a liberation impulse, it came along with this, it was bundled with these binaries of you're not a woman, you're not black, you're not enslaved, you're not indigenous, right? So the goodness of the individual as a place that we could make political claims and do interesting work came along with all these purity politics at the same time.
Yeah.
And also, you know, interestingly, was bundled with impulses to keep the nation pure, right? So having conceptions of nation states came along. And also, like, very quickly, you know, merged into an understanding of, like, the germ theory of disease. So thinking about what is it to be clean, you know, what is it to be... So they're all connected. What is it to master nature?
Yeah, exactly.
All of these things were bundled in with particular... So we inherit that. And the question then is, how do we hold to the insight that we want, you know, my friend's kid to not be subjected to lead paint, right?
Yeah.
Not take that into her body. And give up the idea that the rights of the individual are more important, or like the whims of the individual, really. We've come to a place where it's like a certain number of people just want to have a particular life, and it's like they have a right to have a private jet.
Mm-hmm.
How do we hold a respect for the individual's dignity, and also a respect for the ecology that that individual lives in?
So in a sense, what you're arguing here for, or what you're explaining here to us, it counters a long-standing tradition of how we, especially in the, let's call it Western world, whatever you may call it, that is very much drawing on in this ideal of enlightenment, which is very much about purifying, in the sense of purifying our knowledge, purifying subjectivity from objectivity, male from female, purifying reason, especially from emotion or irrationality. So in a sense, you are countering this by now very deeply ingrained ideology that a lot of our thinking is based on, again, in the so-called Western world. Can you explain a little bit more the concept of purity, especially against this backdrop? Because I think ecological thinking is very much a counter-reaction to this purity thinking, purity politics, coming from the Enlightenment as a project of purification.
The opposite of purity is not toxicity or dirtiness. The opposite of purity is entanglement and connection. And interdependence. So when I say purity or purity politics, what I mean is the lie that we are disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
When I say purity, I mean the pretense, the falsity that we can do anything alone, that we can solve anything alone, that we live alone. So the opposite of purity is recognizing that we are completely enmeshed and dependent in the world, and that that is a beautiful place to start.
Yeah.
Being in the world, entangled with the world, gives us traction for responsibility. One thing that purity politics does, for example, thinking ecologically, is you'll find people who say, you can't tell me you care about the extinction crisis and global warming because you just took a plane trip.
Yeah.
I saw you, you know, you posted about it on social media. And also, you're posting about it on social media. Don't you know the incredible electricity costs of participating in the cloud? So that's one mode of purity politics, that someone will point out, oh, you're a hypocrite.
Yeah.
You think, you know, you do these things, you say these things, but then you do these other things, right? You say you're against global warming, but look at you. You're turning on the heat in your house and you're using your phone. And you don't even care about the people mining rare earth minerals to make your smartphone work. So that's a purity politics move, which is to say, I am pointing out that you're implicated in the very things that you say you oppose, and therefore you should just shut up.
Yeah.
And you can't, you can't make any claim to want the world to be otherwise unless you are completely innocent of implication.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that purity politics really does, is try to shut down the impulse for people to say, I don't think it should be like this.
Mm-hmm.
So purity politics is that demobilizing move. Mm. That's one aspect of it. Purity politics is also, and we see this a lot on the internet and on the left, the move to say, because I'm pointing out something that you're doing wrong, I'm okay. Like, if I'm naming that someone else is doing something, that means I'm safe from someone saying that I'm messing up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another move that purity politics does. A third one is to say that it's not worth doing anything unless we can do everything. So there's an old anarchist slogan that says, to change everything, start anywhere.
Yeah.
And another one that says, we have to demand the impossible. because the things that are possible under the current world are just going to keep being the things that keep this world going. Mm-hmm. So we want to make an irrational demand for something that doesn't exist yet. And so that, I think, is this politics of entanglement, of ecological thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the thing when I'm talking about purity politics or identifying it in myself and other people, right? Because I think this happens all the time,
yeah,
where we say, because I can't solve everything personally, I'm not going to work on anything. Or because I want to take a flight to go see a dear friend, you know, or a family member, I can't make any claims about we're using too much fuel. Jet fuel is terrible, you know? So the antidote is to really have this sense of, it is not because I'm innocent that I have a political stand. It's because I'm implicated that I have a political stand.
Yeah.
It's not because I'm pure that I can make claims about how I want the world to be otherwise. It's because I'm entangled. It's because it is because I can't help but participate in this horrible world-destroying machine that I'm opposing the horrible world-destroying machine.
It's in a sense calling for responsibility, to be kind of, you know, facing the reality of this implicatedness rather than striving for purity, because the only way you can be pure is by not being part of this world.
Yeah, which is not possible. In my book, I talk about this movement called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, which there was a bumper sticker in Santa Cruz where I went to grad school that said, save the world, kill yourself. So that's such a politics of despair.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, no one's death helps the world. Our lives can, though. Mm-hmm. So I love this turn toward thinking about responsibility, because responsibility is what choices do we make given the choices we have?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we create different choices?
Yeah.
So, for example, I often say, in North America, where I live, it is in practice not possible for most people to not own a car. And especially when I lived in the north of Canada, in Sudbury, people, working class people, people living in poverty, often had to own two cars. because one car would break down and they still needed to get to work and they could not get to their home by public transit. It was not possible. So when I say, oh, you should choose to take public transit, if I say that to someone who's living in a place that they do because it's the only place they can afford and there literally is not public transit, that's a politically unintelligible thing for me to say to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, I live in the downtown core. I can cycle to work. I have a bus that goes directly to my university. Very easy. I own a car. It's very easy for me, given the choices I have, to choose to take public transit or bike. So when I say we can decide what choices we make, given the choices we have, for me, I can always make a more ecological choice that also makes me happier. You know, that's good. But if I'm genuine about wanting the world to not be, a horrific combination of on fire, flooding, and completely poisoned, I need to work to make better choices available for everyone, better collective choices. And so that means if I really care, and I take myself as connected to and implicated in, you know, it's the secretary who works in my department who has to drive because she can't afford to live in the downtown core where I live.
Mm-hmm.
If I really care about that, then I need to work on expanding the public transit routes in my city, making transit free, you know, all of these things that are very easy actually to connect to, but that involve connecting with bigger things. The happy thing about that, about working against purity through expanding the scope of responsibility, is that the best antidote I've found to that kind of politics of despair that is about you're supposed to personally save the world is working with other people.
Yeah.
So collectivity is the antidote to alienation and despair. Being more embedded, being more connected. Yeah.
I really love the way you put this. It's turning this I into a we, and also to step away from idealizing, be it concepts or ideologies or movements, but also individual people. I think it's not a coincidence that we right now live in times where superheroes are so popular, because we are looking for, you know, Superman to come save us. And at the same time, we also idealize this heroic entrepreneur that will come up with finally the gadget that will save us all.
Absolutely. The media scape of the superhero connects absolutely to this idea of the ultimately potent individual who single-handedly solves everything. And that's part of a way of thinking about social change that is always trying to find the single charismatic leader who will bring everything, you know? So the sort of impulse to say, Greta Thunberg should be, you know, decide what's going to happen. Or, you know, we want to find these climate heroes.
Yes.
And I think, you know, one of the things that's so helpful about identifying that as a, well, here I'm going to do the purity move. Identifying that as a toxic story is helpful, because I think any of us who really come to this realization that no individual can do it alone, a lot of other things follow. So really starting to have different criteria for what success looks like that isn't individual purity, that isn't individual exhaustion, that isn't individual self-righteousness and being opposed. What this turns us to is this recognition that, again, I think all of us have when we realize that those things don't work, that there has to be something else that works. And the something else that has worked in the past to solve immeasurably complicated, we call them wicked problems.
Wicked problems, yeah.
Wicked problems are problems that are so complicated that anything you try to do is going to create more problems, right? And there's no easy fix. So it's a conundrum.
Yeah.
In the past, right, abolishing chattel slavery was a wicked problem in that whole world systems were built on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's true that when people say, if we abolished fossil fuels tomorrow, lithium mining would just be a huge problem to make batteries. Look at what's happening. Look at cobalt mining. Look at the enslavement of children in cobalt mines to make rechargeable batteries. So yeah, these energy use is a wicked problem. Our world is built on it. We can look at food systems, anything we look at, Ramaphosa becomes really complicated. Mm-hmm. Individual force of will won't change it. Individual martyrdom won't change it.
Yes.
Setting up heroes won't change it. The only thing that has changed wicked problems in the past is masses of ordinary people. Just huge numbers of ordinary people. Caring.
Yeah.
And so right now, it's like when we look, we need hundreds of millions of people to, you know, wherever they are, change everything, right?
Yeah.
Starting anywhere. And, you know, so when I talk to people about the ecological crisis and what it takes, it's not to say you just have to do one small thing, because we need to be sort of, we do need to have some plan. And the thing that we need to do is connect with others, with other ordinary people who are working on the places that they're working, which is the places they care for.
Yeah.
I think that's another way to talk about the opposite of purity is caring.
Caring, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's also an expressing that, I guess, if I understand what you are saying, right, it's caring in a sense that you don't mind getting your hands dirty.
Yeah.
That was a very interesting argument you made, is that, at least the way I understood it, is that one of the purity politics moves is that we conflate kind of like healthy dirt, or just the fact that, you know, that to live is to have your hands dirty. Just to conflate that with toxicity. That seems like a very recent invention to say, yeah, but it's toxic. So we need to get rid of all the dirt and you have to have your hands clean. Otherwise, you are not eligible to participate and to express your political will because you are, as we said before, not pure enough.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that impulse to say, because you're implicated in something you oppose, you can't oppose it. And then the flip of it is to say, because you're involved with it, you might as well not do anything.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
So take as many flights as you want. Don't bother, you know, just do whatever. So I think, you know, the move, the counter move always is to say, yeah, it's because I'm connected that I care. And as soon as I try to do anything, I am definitely going to fuck up because it's too complicated. But that's just the beginning, right?
Yeah.
So we're sort of in the West, especially, there's a certain way that, and I think especially in the current media context where, you know, no one wants to be the main character on Twitter. it can be very easy to just feel like if I make one mistake, that's
absolutely,
it.
Yeah.
I'm canceled. Mm-hmm. It's over for me.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, like, as humans, we are making dreadful mistakes all the time. We're collectively making a dreadful mistake, which is to destroy the world that sustains us. So the only thing we can do is start from being in the wake and in the middle of fucking up. So all of us are imperfect. All of us have made a dreadful error. It is a, we could feel a lot of shame actually about it. And I've written about this, right? Like, if we say, oh, what I feel here is I am ashamed to be involved in this.
Yeah.
You know, that can make us turn inward and curl up and just be like, I'm just not going to think about it. It's too painful. The antidote to that is to say, even though I have made terrible mistakes and I'm part of a species that is bewilderingly destroying the conditions for its own life, I believe that we can have, even from now, even starting now, we can start to repair, although we're still destroying. We can start to make amends, although we're still wounding the world and each other. Like, it's never too late, because it's always been too late. We've never been innocent, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Because we've messed up, therefore we can go on.
It's in a sense also, you know, letting go of this idea that there used to be a paradise and we destroyed it. That, that there was never a paradise, right?
There was never a paradise. And there was never a, you know, we are never going to, I ferment a lot of food. I drink a lot of kombucha. We are never going to be able to eat enough sauerkraut and kombucha to get back to a state of health, you know, of shining skin, glowing, you know.
You are working with activists.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that side of your work, the activist side of how to translate this? Because this may come across as quite, I don't want to call it abstract, because as we established, this is not abstract, but as a guideline for actual activist work. This translation, if you could talk a little bit about that, would be very interesting.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, that tendency that I spoke about to, you know, point a finger at someone else, you're doing it wrong, to expel people whose politics aren't good or who use the wrong language. This is so common in activist scenes. And simultaneously, one of the things that we really find that is very striking is that especially the far right has such a strong purity politics around especially whiteness, the purity of the race, but also disability, right? So a eugenic impulse to kill everyone who isn't able-bodied, able-minded, purity of the nation borders, right? So keep out the other. And, you know, and historically, really interesting and complicated obsessions with bodily cleanliness, all kinds of things. So it's always useful, especially if you're anywhere on the left, which I think basically anyone who thinks that the world should continue and that people should be able to live with it is in some way on the left in this moment. So if you're on the left at all, looking at either those things about the individualizing of purity or the ways that purity politics is mobilized on the right, I think should make us very concerned about that impulse to cast people out, et cetera. But when I say we need hundreds of millions of ordinary people to work together, the difficulty there is that there has been a massive de-skilling of people's capacities for collectivity.
Right. Yeah.
Most people alive today in the West, North America, and much of Europe have never participated in non-hierarchical decision making. They are embedded in fixed hierarchies that have made it very difficult to even come up with ideas for how we would do things. And a sense that it's possible for people to do things themselves, to self-govern, to make collective decisions about the things that matter to them. So a lot of my activist work, aside from the things that is like going to protests and, you know, doing research about police brutality in the city I live in and different things that I do with the political collective I'm part of, a lot of the things that we do are about training and helping people skill up in working together. So in non-hierarchical collective formations where people are collaboratively making decisions using consensus process, where people can set strategic goals for change they want to see, like just knowing how do you set a strategic goal? And what's the difference between a goal you have and the tactics you're going to use to reach it? You know, going and protesting in the street is just one tactic. Writing letters is just one tactic. What's effective? Mm. Neoliberalism and the urge toward individualism have de-skilled people in those capacities. So those are, you know, those are things that I think resisting the purity impulse to be more right than someone else through casting them out, skilling up in collectivity and being able to be together, work together, having a smart relationship with harm and repair, you know, being able to understand, okay, people are going to make mistakes. What does it mean to not give up on anyone? But also, like in my city, in my activist scene, there has been a lot of sexual assault inside the scene.
Okay.
So when one activist rapes another activist,
oh yeah,
what do we do, right? And it's not enough to just say, no one is disposable. We don't want to cast anyone out. Because if you actively welcome the person who's raped someone else, the person they raped won't feel comfortable. So you have to be very direct and real about what it is to live together.
Yeah.
And we find this everywhere, I think. You know, when people have done terrible harm to one another, what does it mean to hold them in community without casting out the people they've harmed? So those are many of the things that come up in the practice of resisting purity politics and embracing entanglement in activist worlds.
And that's why I'm so just fascinated listening to you, because it seems like such a simple term, purity and purity politics, but it covers our entire understanding of what it means to be a human in this world and how to live together, because it goes from how we think about sexuality and queerness to disability to activism, participation, political engagement. And it very much captures the essence of what I think is a root cause of all the woes and problems and crises we are having, is this understanding that the solution is to keep on purifying. It's more purity. When, you know, listening to you, understand that actually it's quite the opposite, is to repair and heal and to understand your own vulnerability, because that's the price of connecting, of being connected, is being vulnerable. And based on that, what would you suggest is kind of the way forward from here, in the terms of how we think, how we interact, how we organize?
Yeah, I love that question. So there's a little zine, small book called Organizing Cools the Planet, which came out a number of years ago. And one of the things that they say in it is, find your front line.
And find your front line?
Your front line, yeah. And what that means is, find the thing that you care about, actually. And start there. So I think there's a lot of ideas about, like, what should people work on? You know, what should they do? And we can't take our activity from someone else's idea. we can take our activity from the things that genuinely move us. And when we start there, then we start to find other people that we genuinely want to work with and be with. So finding the place that, like when we say ecological thinking, that can feel like, what is that even, you know? But what it is we're connected to everything, right? We are connected to everything, but we're not connected to everything equally to the same degree in the same way. So earlier we were talking about that quality of taking responsibility for what we can become responsive to. So what are the things that we can become responsible with, you know? What can we take responsibility to? So for some people, that's like they have in their job something that could change. And there's other people who also care about that in the place that they work. Some people, there's something happening in the city they live in. For some people, like when I lived in Sudbury, one of the things that I cared about a lot was the mining company that ran the mine that is underneath the city of Sudbury is massively responsible for horrific wrongs in mines in South America. So that was something that's like very geographically distant, but very close to where I was because of the company that ran the town I lived in was responsible for murdering people who were doing union activism in these other places. So I think the main thing is to start from where do you have something that you care for? And how can you amplify that and become more connected with it and other people who also care for it? My friend Dan has this t-shirt that says, please still try. And in my collective, our collective t-shirts on the back, they say, don't give up. And those things really, you know, it's like, although it is currently impossible, please still try. You know, although it feels overwhelming, don't give up. Find other people and figure out how you can find the place that you work. And then it's okay that there's so many other things that you could work on, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're working on this. So it's like that impulse, you know, become more entangled, skill up in collectivity, find the things that are connective and where you feel like it's possible to not despair. That's that quality of like collectivity is the antidote to alienation. It's really true, I think. Like I sound like I'm proselytizing and it's because I am. We live in terrible times right now. It's horribly difficult to imagine a way out. But this isn't the only time that it's felt like this in the history of the world.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and we came through ordinary people doing amazing things. So I think that because all of us are ordinary, we can say, therefore, we can do amazing things.
No, I love that. It's this transition from a fuck it attitude to a don't give up attitude. I think that really nicely sums it all up.
Or we could say, fuck it, I'm still going to try.
Oh, yeah, that's even better. There you go. Fuck it, we're still trying.
If we have a different fuck it attitude, I'm still going to try.
Yeah, fuck it, but not the way we... you may think. No, it was a beautiful conversation. I really learned so much from you. So thank you so much for joining us here. And, you know, before I let you go, I would just love to hear kind of your final words, if you have them for our audience. Because, you know, the motto of our podcast is that the ecological crisis is foremost a crisis in our ways of thinking. And I was wondering what you would like the audience to kind of remember or get out of this conversation, how this ecological crisis kind of expresses itself in the way we live with each other, and how we can go about kind of rethinking that and then ultimately also changing that ecology of ideas.
So I think the main thing that I would say to close is I really believe that we can build tremendous meaning in the horrific things that we're encountering.
Yeah.
I think that holding to the commitment that the world does not have to be this way is almost embarrassing in its earnestness, you know? But I want us all to be earnest and playful and serious about the idea that it doesn't have to continue the way it's been going. And as someone who studies social movements, I also feel like it's important to remember that we're not alone, you know, that individualism and purity politics wants us to think that we're all alone and we're the only ones who care. And this is not true. There are, in fact, hundreds of millions of people who care. So because we're all implicated, because we're all impure, we can come together. And actually, it's meaningful and good to keep trying like that.
Yeah.
And it's very deeply ingrained in the way we live, also evolved, because in order to survive, we need help. Just starting with the bacteria in our guts, to our neighbors, to the clothes we are wearing, to the food we need to eat, the fire in order to keep us warm. We need help to survive.
Yeah.
So,
and it's beautiful to think about that, right? The incredible generosity of the world, you know? And then it's to ask, like, how could we be generous back?
Exactly.
Having received everything, how do we give everything, right?
So I guess that's a very nice way of finishing this up. Being generous. Fuck it and be generous, I guess.
That's a
good way to finish this up. Thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure to have you, Alexis. I really learned so much.
It was such a pleasure,
beautiful.
To be
and really appreciate having you. So thank you very much. And
thank you.
This was the Ecology of Ideas podcast. Production and editing by Emil Munk. My name is Otto Lematon, co-producer and host. Special thanks to the Copenhagen Business School for financing this episode, and to Jakob Ranum, sound engineer at Studio 25 in Copenhagen, where we recorded this episode. Thanks for listening, and we are